All right, welcome back everyone to the deep dive. We've got a really interesting case to dig into today, one that I think, you know, especially for all the law students out there, has some really important lessons about police interrogation tactics and the way confessions are used in court. We're going to be talking about Commonwealth v. DiGiambattista, a 2004 case out of Massachusetts.
Yeah, this case really gets at the heart of some tricky legal issues, like where's the line between legitimate police work and actually coercing a suspect into confessing to something they maybe didn't even do.
Right. And, you know, it's not just theoretical. This case led to a very specific jury instruction that's now used in Massachusetts and has influenced courts in other states as well. So let's just jump right in. Can you give us the basic facts of the case?
Sure. So basically, you have Valerio DiGiambattista. He was convicted of arson back in 2004. And the prosecution's case, their whole argument that he was guilty, pretty much rested on this confession that he gave to the police.
A confession, huh? Well, that sounds pretty straightforward. What's so controversial about that?
Well, it's how that confession was obtained that really makes this case interesting. For one thing, the interrogation wasn't recorded. And on top of that, the police used some pretty, well, some might say questionable tactics to get DiGiambattista to talk.
Okay, now you've got my attention.
Oh.
What kind of tactics are we talking about here?
Well, for starters, they showed him blank videotapes.
Blank videotapes, like literally nothing on them.
Yep, empty tapes. But they presented them to DiGiambattista as if they were actual recordings of him at the scene of the fire, setting the place ablaze.
Wow. So they were straight up lying to him.
Yeah. And they didn't stop there. They also showed him a fake evidence folder.
Hold on. A fake folder? Like a prop from a movie set or something?
Pretty much. It was designed to make him think they had all this incriminating evidence against him. You know, lab reports, witness statements, the whole nine yards. But none of it was real.
That's pretty wild. I mean, talk about psychological pressure.
Right. It's like, imagine being in that situation. You're already in a vulnerable position, being questioned by the police, and then they hit you with this fake evidence. You might start to doubt your own memory, your own innocence.
Yeah, absolutely. And it seems like they didn't just try to scare him into confessing. They also kind of downplayed the whole arson thing, didn't they?
Exactly. They started talking about how it was probably just stress, you know, or maybe he had been drinking too much and just made a mistake. They even suggested that he needed counseling, framing it as a personal issue rather than a serious crime.
So kind of like, it's okay. We understand. Just need a little help.
Yeah. And this is where things get even more interesting, because later on, when they actually investigated the arson, some of the details in DiGiambattista's confession just didn't add up. Like, he talked about buying a specific type of gas can to start the fire, but it turned out that kind of gas can doesn't even exist. And the forensic evidence from the scene didn't match up with his story either.
So his confession had some pretty big holes in it, but the jury still convicted him.
They did. And this is a huge point for law students to remember. A confession, even one with inconsistencies, can be really persuasive to a jury. It's often seen as the most damning evidence.
It's like, why would someone confess to something they didn't do?
Right. But this case really highlights how a confession that seems voluntary on the surface might actually be the result of really subtle but powerful coercive tactics.
So what happened next? DiGiambattista appealed the conviction, right?
He did. He argued that his confession was coerced and shouldn't have been used against him. His lawyers basically said that the police tactics created this atmosphere of pressure where he felt like he had no choice but to confess, even if it meant admitting to things that weren't true.
And what did the court say?
Well, at first, both the Superior Court and the Appeals Court upheld the conviction. They didn't see the police tactic as being coercive enough to throw out the confession.
So they were okay with the blank tapes and the fake evidence folder and all that.
Yeah. But then the case went to the highest court in Massachusetts, the Supreme Judicial Court, or SJC for short. And they saw things a bit differently.
So the SJC reversed the conviction.
They did. And their reasoning is really important. They said that when you look at all the circumstances surrounding the confession, the totality of the circumstances, as they put it, it's clear that DiGiambattista's will was overborne by the police. It wasn't just one tactic, but the combination of everything, the trickery, the minimization of the crime, the suggestion of counseling instead of jail time, it all added up to a situation where his confession wasn't truly voluntary.
Okay, let's break down some of the key legal issues here, because I think this is where it gets really relevant for anyone studying law. First up, the whole idea of a voluntary confession. What does that actually mean in legal terms?
Right. So for a confession to be admissible in court, it has to be voluntary. It can't be the result of coercion or threats or promises. And the courts use this totality of the circumstances test to figure that out.
So they don't just look at one thing in isolation. They look at the whole picture.
Exactly. They consider everything the suspect's age, their education, their mental state, how long the interrogation lasted, where it took place, and of course, the specific tactics used by the police. And in this case, the SJC found that the combination of all those factors in DGM Batista's case meant that his confession wasn't actually a product of his own free will.
So even though the police didn't, like, physically beat him or anything, the psychological pressure was enough to make the confession inadmissible.
Right. And the SJC actually quoted their own definition of a voluntary statement from a previous case, saying that it has to be the product of a rational intellect and free will. And they found that the police tactics in this case, especially since the interrogation wasn't recorded, interfered with DGM Batista's ability to think clearly and make a rational decision about whether to confess.
Now, I know the police are allowed to use some deception during interrogations, right?
Yeah.
Like they can pretend to have more evidence than they actually do, or they can lie about what a witness said. So where's the line? When does it become too much?
That's the big question, isn't it? And the DGM Batista case kind of helps to clarify that line. The court said that trickery by itself might not be enough to make a confession involuntary. But when you combine that trickery with other things, like suggesting that the suspect will get leniency or a lighter sentence if they confess, that's when it crosses the line into coercion.
So in this case, it wasn't just the fake evidence. It was also the way they minimized the crime and implied that he could just get some counseling and everything would be fine.
Right. And that's really important for law students to understand. It's the totality of the circumstances, the combination of all those factors that the courts will look at when deciding if a confession is admissible.
Now, it's worth pointing out that not everyone agreed with the SJC's decision in this case. There was a dissenting opinion, right?
There was. One of the justices, Justice Spina, argued pretty strongly that the confession was voluntary. He thought the majority was overstepping its bounds by creating this new rule about unrecorded confessions. And he was skeptical of the research about false confessions that the majority relied on.
So he thought the police were just doing their job, trying to get a confession, and the court shouldn't be second-guessing their methods.
Basically, yeah. He saw it as a case of judicial overreach, trying to micromanage police investigations.
And this brings us to another really important legal issue that came out of this case, the recording requirement. Or I guess I should say the lack of a recording requirement. Because the SJC didn't actually say that police have to record all interrogations, did they?
No, they didn't. They strongly encouraged recording, and they said it should be done whenever it's practical, but they stopped short of making it a legal requirement.
But they did create a new rule about how juries should be instructed when they hear about a confession that wasn't recorded.
Right, exactly. They said that if a confession wasn't recorded, the judge has to tell the jury that they should view that confession with skepticism.
So even though the police don't have to record, if they choose not to, it makes it a lot harder for the prosecution to use that confession in court.
Exactly. The SJC basically said it's only fair to point out to the jury that the side with the burden of proof, the prosecution, decided not to create a more reliable record of the interrogation. It kind of puts the prosecution on the defensive, like they have to explain why they didn't record.
It almost seems like a nudge, you know, to encourage police departments to start recording more interrogations.
I think that was definitely part of the thinking behind it. And a lot of states have actually moved towards mandatory recording since this case.
Interesting. Okay, so we've talked about voluntariness and recording. There's one more key legal issue I want to touch on. The corroboration rule. Can you remind us what that is and how it played into the DGM Batista case?
Sure. So the corroboration rule basically says that you can't convict someone solely on the basis of their own confession. There has to be some other evidence independent of the confession that the crime actually happened. And in this case, there was independent evidence of arson. The house did burn down. But the problem was that DGM Batista's confession had so many inconsistencies, so many details that didn't match up with the facts, that the SJC didn't think it was reliable enough to be the sole basis for saying he was the one who set the fire.
So even though they couldn't use the confession alone to convict him, the other evidence was enough to prove that the crime of arson had been committed.
Right. But it wasn't enough to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that DGM Batista was the one who did it. And because of the confession wasn't considered reliable, they had to overturn the conviction.
So let's go back to those concurring and dissenting opinions. You mentioned that Justice Greeney agreed with the outcome, but had some concerns about the jury instruction. What were those concerns?
Yeah, so Justice Greeney basically thought the instruction about viewing an unrecorded confession with skepticism was a bit too strong. He worried that it might cause juries to automatically dismiss any confession that wasn't recorded, even if there were good reasons for not recording it. He thought it should be more up to the jury to decide how much weight to give the lack of a recording, considering all the other circumstances.
So he was on board with the general idea, just thought the specific wording was a bit too harsh on the prosecution.
Right. And then you have Justice Spina's dissent, which we talked about earlier. He was much more critical of the whole decision. He thought the majority was basically inventing a new rule out of thin air and interfering with legitimate police work.
So you have this really interesting split on the court, which I think reflects a larger debate in the legal system about how to balance the need for effective law enforcement with the need to protect individual rights.
Absolutely. And this case really brings those tensions to the forefront.
All right, so we've covered a lot of ground here. What are some of the key takeaways from the DiGiambattista case, especially for those who are just starting out in law school?
Well, I think the biggest lesson is to really understand the totality of the circumstances test. It comes up all the time in criminal law, and this case is a perfect example of how it's applied in the real world. You also see how important it is to understand the nuances of police interrogation tactics and how seemingly small things, like the way a question is phrased or the tone of voice used, can have a big impact on whether a confession is considered voluntary.
And it's a reminder that confessions aren't always what they seem. They can be unreliable, even if they sound convincing at first.
Right. You have to look at the whole picture, all the surrounding circumstances, before deciding if a confession is truly voluntary and reliable.
And I think this case also shows how important it is to have a system of checks and balances, with the courts playing a role in making sure that police investigations are conducted fairly and that people's rights are protected.
Absolutely. And that's why cases like DiGiambattista are so important to study. They give you a glimpse into the complexities of the criminal justice system and the ongoing debates about how to ensure both fairness and effectiveness.
So to wrap things up, Commonwealth v. DiGiambattista is a case that really makes you think about the power of a confession and the responsibilities of both the police and the courts when it comes to obtaining and evaluating confessions. It's a case that has had a lasting impact on the law, especially in Massachusetts, and is one that every law student should know.
I think that's a great summary. It's a case that raises important questions about the limits of police power, the psychology of interrogation, and the fundamental fairness of our criminal justice system. And those are questions that are still being debated today.
Absolutely. Well, thank you for taking us on this deep dive into Commonwealth v. DiGiambattista. It's been a fascinating and thought-provoking discussion. And for all our listeners out there, keep those legal minds sharp, and we'll see you next time on The Deep Dive.